beautiful. I love kind of the back and forth of being really spirited and back.
It's really nice. So right now, we've been going through a new sermon series called Jesus' Third Way for the Third Rail. And what we're trying to do is see how Jesus experienced some of the same things that we probably see around us in our lives and in our culture right now, where there's lots of entrenched controversies, everybody kind of draws their battle lines and dukes it out, and for many of us we see at least a lot of how that goes to be very unhealthy, toxic, not really making progress for the things that we care most about. And we would say, God, the things that we struggle with the most in our lives, maybe we're not used to always talking about them in church or thinking about them in our faith, but we believe that you can come into any of those circumstances and bring wholeness and healing to them and help us to participate in that. And so how do we learn how to do that in those things that are especially difficult in our culture? And I believe that we can look at Jesus as an example in particular, and that's what we're trying to do right now, is realize that Jesus entered into a culture that was very similar with those same issues. A couple weeks ago, we looked at the fact that there were actually four big camps that looked at the controversies of their day, and in particular the problems of having been conquered by the Roman Empire, and wondering, what are we going to do about that? How will God help us get out of this? And they all had different approaches and were very antagonistic to each other about what they thought would be best. And yet, Jesus was able to gather together, starting with the disciples and then continuing that spirit into the early church, people of all of those different perspectives, all of those different camps, and somehow give them a new identity and a new community to participate in that lifted them out of all of that muck and mire of what was going on culturally that was not actually helpful or healthy. And then last week we looked at how Jesus not only gathers us as a community and gives us that new way of relating to each other, but some of the specific controversies that people tried to drag Jesus into and say, you must end up only in this particular perspective or camp, right, Jesus? And then see what controversy and complication that caused for him. But Jesus took those high-stakes things, and last week we looked at the controversy, what must I do to be saved? And we saw how Jesus was willing to look at the question behind the question and not get sucked into an unhealthy debate, but to see what people were really struggling with the most and then invite them to get caught up in God's salvation story and see their role in it, that again could transcend the things that were most intractable at their time and place and give them a way of having a new way of life, a new way of facing it that didn't get sucked into all those things and had a place for everyone, even that seemed to be enemies. Today we'll continue to learn from Jesus with another really entrenched issue. And it might seem like this controversial topic is not very relatable. Our Bible verse from the Gospels seems like probably a strange topic about, not something that we necessarily argue about a lot in our culture. But perhaps at the very least we can recognize the strategy of conversation that the Sadducees brought to Jesus in asking him about resurrection and a woman who would be married subsequently to a series of brothers and whose wife she would ultimately be. Because I think that this is an example of something we're very familiar with. This was a first century pre-social media troll. See, the Sadducees didn't actually believe in resurrection that they were asking Jesus about, and they weren't trying to go into the conversation with him in good faith about it either. They thought that they had come up with this really clever, smug way of saying, see, Jesus, this idea of resurrection is totally ridiculous. We aren't even going to think about why it's important to people. We'll just point out, look at this weird complication, this weird exception of, you know, how could you possibly believe in resurrection if you're going to have this woman who's going to have to be married to seven different men? So it's obviously ridiculous. You won't even take it seriously. They tried to get Jesus with just some strange logic bomb instead of actually engaging in meaningful conversation. But apparently we see that Jesus kind of drops the mic back on the Sadducees because the response that he gives them causes them to not respond and no one else to try to challenge him either, and that the crowds that are gathered are astonished at the teaching that he gives. But I don't know if it's as easy for us. We probably are excited to say, yeah, Jesus told off those mean Sadducees, and we're really glad, and good job, Jesus, and that's why we believe in you. But it might be hard for us to see why was it that Jesus' response was so convincing. Jesus tells the Sadducees that they don't know Scripture, but I don't know how many of us have a memory verse that comes instantly to mind about marrying lots of different siblings. Jesus says that people won't marry or be given in marriage at the resurrection, but I know especially at a time like All Saints Day, many of us find this to be a difficult verse to hear because we don't want to lose that connection to our spouses and our loved ones. And then Jesus says that God is the God of the living but not the dead, and yet he lists off who? Three dead guys. So what is it that Jesus was actually up to raise that conversation out of the troll territory that the Sadducees were trying to put it in? There are, in fact, powerful lessons that Jesus is giving us, both about entering into controversial topics like we've been talking about so far, but also specifically about managing our relationships overall. We may have to look and listen pretty closely and carefully to see them. The first place to start is we should just remember the strangeness of the marriage example in the first place. There were instructions in the law that Moses gave in other parts of Leviticus, Numbers, Exodus, Deuteronomy, besides what Peggy read, that talked about marriage, and that would seem very strange to us today. There was a prescription that if a man died before that he had any children, that arrangements would be made for the wife to be able to be connected with someone else, and the family member of the man would be the first backup. But any children that came from that union would actually not be part of the living brother's family. It would be part of the man who died, his family, so that his name and his legacy could be passed on, that was the idea. There's also a chance of trying to make sure that a woman had a livelihood, because there were not opportunities for going out and getting a job as a woman in that culture. And so there were arrangements essentially to make sure that everyone would be taken care of. What we can hear in this that's especially different than how we normally think about marriage in our culture is that this would not have been a series of deeply romantic, loving, swooning, head over heels types of relationships that this woman that the Sadducees hypothetically brought up had with each subsequent brother. These were essentially legacy relationships, transactional relationships, almost like a business relationship. So the Sadducees, we have to see, were essentially saying to Jesus that resurrection couldn't possibly exist, not because that they hadn't seen examples of it, or not because there were other Bible verses that seemed to say that it wouldn't happen, or even because it didn't seem physically or scientifically possible to them. They were essentially telling Jesus that resurrection couldn't possibly happen because who would legally be responsible for the woman in the resurrection? It's too complicated. It's basically like a bunch of cheapskates arguing over the bill after a fancy dinner. And so now maybe we can see why Jesus was saying that that's not what the resurrection is about. It makes more sense and is incredibly powerful, both to his audience at the time and can be to us, because it's not as harsh as it seems for the best parts of those loving relationships that we value most. Jesus was changing the nature of the conversation on them. He was saying this isn't about scoring debate points on technicalities or trying to prove or disprove a doctrine. Jesus was reminding them in the resurrection, in God's new life, our relationships are not transactions. Living, breathing, precious children of God do not get stuck in systems in the resurrection, in God's new way of life, where they are treated like objects or property anymore. Lives and relationships will be transformed so that they're about the things that are most beautiful and dignified and the affirming connections between each other and between us and God. And that's what the resurrection is about. Not about passing responsibility around on somebody who we barely even see as a person. That is a really beautiful picture of life to be encouraged to, right? I mean, almost no one wants to feel like all of their relationships are really just about cost-benefit analysis or negotiating how much we have to do in order for a person to appreciate us or anything like that. It's a positive message. It seems to get at what the Sadducees were saying and can also put a nice bow on a sermon, right? Wrap it all up, Rob. We're good to go. Don't treat people like transactions. Right? See a living, breathing person in front of you. Unfortunately, I think we have to admit that the lesson is actually not that easy and straightforward. And if it's really going to help us in the problems that we're facing in our culture today, all the ugliness, all the unproductive interactions swirling around us all the time, we're going to have to let God take us deeper on a few things. And I'll start with myself. I had a really super prejudiced and selfish drive to church this morning. See, I followed each line that I saw painted on the road without considering what each one was trying to tell me individually from their experience. I obeyed all the traffic lights without confirming that each one meant the same thing as I came to it with red and green, and without checking with the other person at the intersection if they had an experience and that the traffic lights would work as well for them. And Aislinn and I picked a restaurant to get some breakfast because I expected, from having been to other restaurants like that before, that they'd have the food that I wanted. And then I made my order without knowing if the employee felt like that was what they were most able to do in their skills. I know all of these examples are tongue-in-cheek, and I don't mean to make light of things. It might seem superficial, but I mention them so that we can be honest together about something that's true for all of us. It is actually pretty difficult to avoid being transactional in our relationships, especially with people who aren't super close to us, who we pass on the street, who we see represented on a computer screen and our social media feeds. Because our brains and bodies are hardwired to try to see patterns, to make assumptions, to make sure that the world feels predictable and comfortable to us so that we don't go crazy. I know a lot of times we talk about wanting to say that, oh no, I would never make assumptions about people. I try to see each situation individually, which is a good spirit, but it's okay and just true that our brains need to understand things based on things we've seen before. And then their brain helps us to decide what to do next. And that's just something that's a part of our human experience, and we can't get away from it. And even in our closest relationships, there will be a constant inclination to do things transactionally, with assumptions, with predictions. I can think of a lot of times recently where I have not spent as much time with Wendy and the kids as I might have, even especially when the kids are excited to share something with me that they had done during the day or that they wanted to do together. Because I say something like, I just don't have enough left in the tank. And I'm going to guess that we can all relate to that. And the thing is, feeling like that, needing to rely on our predictions and assumptions, right? It might sound horrible when I give an example like that, because who wants to say that they don't want to spend time with an excited kid? Especially, I'm sure many of you would remind me how there will be a time very, very soon where they will want nothing to do with me if they can help it. They'll want to do lots of other much cooler things than hang out with their dad. But it is also true that self-care and setting healthy boundaries is important. So is there an easy resolution? How are we supposed to feel about all of that? And I think we've got to start by just acknowledging that this struggle is real. We're going, because we are human, to have things where we want to see a sense of exchange, of balance, of taking care of ourselves and our own perspective, of needing our own patterns and predictability to be able to get by, of having relationships risk feeling like transactions, just because that's part of human experience. I watched an interview recently with a scientist and author named Lisa Feldman Barrett. She wrote a book called How Emotions Are Made, and her work studies how the human brain works, and in particular how it interacts with other metabolic processes in the body. She was talking about the challenge of empathy, And why moving past transactional approaches with people so that we can make better, deeper, more meaningful connections and not just serve ourselves is actually incredibly difficult. One key aspect is what I talked about earlier, that our brain needs to set patterns and about things so that it can have a sense of predictability. That's great for following traffic laws and make sure that we all stay alive. But it can cause big problems, I think we know, when we apply that type of assuming to groups of people that we see as different than us. So our ability to empathize and connect beyond transaction can get a lot harder. Another reason beyond those patterns and predictability is how much work it actually takes for our bodies to keep things going. Our brain's got to help our heart beat, our lungs breathe, our stomach to digest, our muscles and skeleton to move, our emotions to work without driving us too crazy, and on and on and on and on and on. I think a really good example of what the impact when this isn't working so good is those classic Snickers commercials where we're not ourselves and we're angry, right? So you got Betty White trying to play football, I think is one of those, right? All these funny misplacements of identity, right? There are things that can really make it hard for us to be what we know, that where we're at our best and where we're following the way that God is calling us to interact with each other. And there is tons of evidence to show that when any of those processes that our brain is responsible for starts to get a lot of stress, whether it's a specific instance of trauma or there's lots of stress over an extended period of time, where there's a life without a lot of resources or a life with a lot of things bombarding people, the first thing for the brain to run out of energy for is our ability to see other people as people and not just objects that cause more stress or offer relief, not just things that are easy or difficult to understand, not just things that will make my life and the lives of people most like me either easier or harder. So there we go. That is about as clear an explanation that I can think of for why we're experiencing so much of what we are experiencing in society right now, especially around our ability to have healthy relationships and our ability to deal with challenges and controversies that face all of us and do so in a healthy way that will bring wholeness to any of us. COVID and everything else is basically doing all of those things to all of our brains all of the time that make it harder to have our relationships transformed by God and be marked by God's heart rather than driven by transactions. So what does Jesus' example and our scriptures do for us there? Does it feel overwhelming and like we're trapped? We can't possibly get out of all of these things that affect us so much? We might feel like the Sadducees. Remember, they were collaborators. That was their perspective, that the Romans had conquered them, and we shouldn't try to fight back. We shouldn't try to make noise. We shouldn't try to make things difficult. Don't ask for justice when we're being mistreated. Just cozy up to the Romans, and they'll make us comfortable, or at least enough of us comfortable. The smart ones, the good ones, or whatever the Sadducees would decide. So Jesus is saying, stop thinking about those relationships like transactions. God has something more transformational and beautiful for us. A whole new life where we don't get stuck in all of that, where we don't oppress each other. We don't have to think about how to juggle people oppressing us, and then we can just try to make sure we get enough tasty crumbs, even if it's at the expense of someone else. The Sadducees probably had a really hard time picturing that type of world and how we would get there, just like we might be feeling if we look at things around us. And especially if they only were willing to believe at what was right in front of them and not a new life. But I can see Jesus believing in something that's hard for us, but is so powerful. And is also like the big idea behind our Old Testament scripture today. Jesus believed that the God who created the universe is a God of abundance, not a God of scarcity. That God didn't design things to be where there was only so much to go around, and our job in life to get salvation was to get on God's good side enough so that we could get as much of the limited supply as possible and leave other people out if we could justify that they didn't deserve it. God designed a world where we can have transformational rather than transactional relationships and find beauty and joy and satisfaction in the world and the people that God has made, because God has made it so abundantly and so beautifully. If we have faith in what God has done, we can let go of making everything about us and have a bigger life because of what we share. A bigger life because our world is expanded by the other people and things that God gives to all of us as a gift. That was the point of the Jubilee that Peggy pointed out was the context of our Bible verses today. This was God saying, this is how our country is going to work in its socioeconomics, in its politics. We want to make sure that everybody has a place. So to start, when you go into the land, everyone's going to have a plot. Each family will have something that they can take care of. But we know that things will happen. Some people won't be as good at farming as others. Some people will have weather that affects them that didn't affect people on the other side of the country. And so there will be times where people will decide, I think to get by, I'm going to have to sell my land to somebody else that had things go better for them, and then I'll just work, or I'll get some gleanings from the field, and I'll get by. God will take care of me through those types of systems, but I won't have that land anymore. But what was supposed to happen is that every 7 years, not only would people get a break, but the land would get a break. So don't grow on the land, let it rest. Let people rest and have the chance to get their land back and buy it off with a certain amount of a fair price based on how many years they think they could get it back for again. But then, at the 50th year, after seven collections of seven, everybody got to go back to their original land, free and clear, starting fresh again, after a generation or two, essentially. And God's saying, I'm going to make sure that everybody gets their chance. We're not going to look at our land. We're not going to look at our crops. We're not going to look at each other in particular as transactions, as dollar signs, as things that we can take advantage of. We're going to see each other's dignity. We're going to see each other's beauty. And we're going to trust that God will take care of us, even if I can't accumulate and accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. And so God in our verses tells the people and tells any of us, remember, I gave you enough. Keep circling back to make sure that all of my beloved children are doing well. Find a way to empathize with them and their struggles. Remember what the verse says in particular. It's because, first of all of the things that you see around you, all the things that you want to accumulate, they're mine. They're not yours. I could have treated you like foreigners and aliens and strangers with what I have, but instead I treated you as children. I love you too much to see you as a transaction. And I'll help you have the power to love each other, to not see each other as transactions either. Probably seems crazy and impossible. Some scholars say that maybe the Israelites never ended up actually practicing this, even though it was commanded by God. But that is the root of living a life of faith. We take courage. It's honest and good to admit how empty our tanks can feel sometimes and how easily we can become transactional because of it. But don't forget the Creator of the universe is offering to help fill you back up. And He sees helping us have transformational relationships rather than transactional ones as one of the biggest priorities of salvation and new life together. Days like today help us remember these lessons. When we celebrate All Saints Day, we're encouraged to hold on to that transformational legacy that all of our loved ones have left, and how that is what's most important about who they are and how we remember them. It's easier for us to let all the transactional parts of relationship fall away from how we remember people and focus on what lasts and what's most important. It's the aspects of their life that affirm their full entry into God's kingdom and will sustain our connection with them now and forever. And similarly, participating in things like prayer for the persecuted Christians helps exercise our empathy and our ability to recognize what is it that really causes persecution. How can we hopefully avoid the temptation to do that ourselves when we have any influence? By resisting that transactional mindset. And therefore, ask and invite the power of God's transformational influence to persevere and resist even the worst parts of life. So, we can recognize that we tap into exactly that power of God's love, even when we enter into controversy. God will help show us how to, like Jesus, get away from trying to win the fruitless, false, worldly competition, and instead how to be honest with our struggles. How to have room to hear someone else's struggles, even if they're different than ours, but they're still important. Show us how to believe in an abundance where we can focus on justice and goodness for everyone, and not just affluence and hoarding for me and mine. And how to enter into a new life as God's people that raises us all out of the intractability, out of the toxicity, out of death, and into a way of life that is more than transactions. We'll participate now in a rite together that bonds us in that transformational love of God and shows us that powerful example of Jesus most of all, and how Jesus saw us as more than transactions and was willing to give his life for us. And I invite you to take out your communion elements and be in God's transformational presence with me. Gracious God, we come to your table this morning desiring the deep and meaningful connection that your Spirit brings. We thank you for how you reconcile us to yourself and how you empower us to be your people by connecting us with our brothers and sisters in this local church, around the world, and even across the apparent boundaries of time and death. Lord, we confess that we can come to your table hungry. We can come to your table wondering whether you can fill us up with all it is that we need to face the world around us. When we feel empty, we are prone to forgetting your grace and your abundance. And we'll focus more on transactional connections that are about us rather than the transformational new life and loving extended family that you offer. Help us to find our hope in you and the way of life that transcends our petty grievances and competitions for comfort. This morning, may your welcome help our own spirit of welcoming. May your abundance make us conscious of what we can share and hold together with others. And may your sacrifice help us know how to give of ourselves with your children in our daily lives. And so we turn ourselves to you, God, Father and Creator of all people, who sees all of us and all of the world as we truly are, honors what you have put in each of us that is truly valuable, and calls us out of the things which keep us from being who you have made us to be. We offer ourselves to you, Son, who gave us the ultimate example of living transformational life, who resisted the pull to treat others as transactions, who loved and forgave even those who did not recognize you, who persecuted you and put you to death, and you who are first in the resurrection of new life, that lifts us out of our suffering, out of our oppression, and out of death. And we offer ourselves to you, Spirit, who binds us together with all of God's children across all obstacles, and enables us to the most transformational of connections with each other and with our Maker. On the night that he was betrayed, sold, and executed, Jesus brought his disciples together and taught them again about the radical way of life that he was ushering in. He washed their feet, though he was the greatest among them. He reminded them that they would be known as God's people through love rather than domination. And he rooted them again in the meal, Passover, that marked them as the descendants of those who were once property, but were free to be a people meant to bless the nations around them. Taking the bread, he gave thanks to God, and broke it, and passed it amongst those who had fought over who was greatest. He said, "Take and eat. This is my body, which is given for you.
do this in remembrance of me. And then after the meal, he took the cup and again gave thanks and passed it amongst those who would soon learn to brave service and suffering together for God's kingdom, and said, "Drink from this. It is my blood of the new covenant poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." Now, Lord, pour out your gathering, bonding spirit on these elements as we continue to find ways to hold together as a community across time and space. Pour out your inspiring, strengthening spirit on these elements as we admit the need to be filled, our temptation to seek transactions, and we offer our desire to you to be marked instead by transformation. So for all of you joining us, again, I invite you to take first the bread. Know that this is the body of Christ broken for you. Take also your cup, and know this is the blood of the new covenant poured out for you. Gracious God, thank you for your loving transformational presence. Thank you that though you have seen us as strangers and aliens and property, that you saw us as your children and loved us in ways that we can bear with them. Help us to carry that presence and that power and encouragement with us in all we do going forward. Amen.